Sound On, the insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country.
Who do you think Biden has to watch in terms of moderate defectors?
The House has been voting for this stimulus package basically for months.
Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I am the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. We begin tonight with the big story. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell reiterated today on Capitol Hill that the labor market has a long way to go as it recovers from jobs lost in the pandemic. I've got sound on this from his testimony before the House Financial Services Committee. Take a listen.
We have 10 million fewer people working on payroll jobs than we had just 1 year ago today, and that the unemployment rate, the reported rate, is 6.3%. But if you include people who were in the labor force and indeed working in February and a couple of other adjustments, you get to almost a 10% unemployment rate. So there's a lot of slack in the labor market and a long way to go to maximum employment.
Let's go right to Capitol Hill, where the Budget Committee Chairman, John Yarmuth, a Democrat from Kentucky, is joining us. Mr. Chairman, thank you for joining us. I got to be candid here. There's a real partisan debate that has emerged on minimum wage that's a part of this $1.9 trillion stimulus deal. You heard it right there from the Fed chairman, the need for more economic support. When can that minimum wage get raised?
Well, we hope in a couple weeks. We're going to put it in, I mean, it's in the House bill that we're going to pass on Friday night, taking it to $15 an hour by 2025. And, you know, it may face some challenges in the Senate, but we're going to pass it here in the House and see what the Senate does with it.
When you hear Republicans say that the minimum wage is just something that financially the country nor small businesses can afford, what is your response to that criticism?
Well, my response is that, you know, 6-8 months ago, we were paying tribute, honoring people like the grocery shelf stockers and bus drivers and sanitation workers and people who were doing jobs that we never thought were really critical. And now we found out that they're critical. And I think now it's time that we actually reward them financially for the important work that they're doing. But beyond those people, we haven't raised the federal minimum wage since 2007. That was my first month on the job here. And meanwhile, most areas of the country are already at $10, $11, $12 an hour or more. So what we found in places like Seattle and other places is that when you raise the minimum wage, the economy actually prospers. You have so many more people who are out being spenders, all of that money goes back into those economies and it ends up being a growth stimulus proposal and not something that kills jobs.
You know, I was struck by this, that in addition to the minimum wage, the Republicans are also raising the issue that they feel that they don't want to have to bail out states that they argue are controlled by Democrats and that quite frankly, that they shouldn't be, that their taxpayer constituents shouldn't be on the hook for it. Do you agree? I take it you don't agree with that assessment.
No, I had a meeting the other day with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, for instance. There were a lot of Republicans on that Zoom meeting, and all of them are very enthusiastic about this package. People like Jim Justice in West Virginia and Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas, very, very red states, think this is a good idea. They need the help. And, you know, I know that the states have differed in how much revenue they've lost, but every state has suffered an economic impact. And the money that we're providing here doesn't just go to make up for lost revenues. It also enables states to do things that help save businesses and help save institutions in their community and their state. So this is something that is way beyond just replacing tax revenue. And again, I don't think we have red roads and blue roads, at least I haven't seen many, or red water systems or blue water systems or red schools or blue schools. And that's the way we're looking at this. Every state has been impacted.
Chairman Yarmuth, I always find this fascinating that you were actually the congressman for for Leader McConnell's congressional district. I never knew that until my show prep this morning. How's that relationship? Yeah.
Well, I've known Mitch for a long time, since 1968. I was a Republican, actually, until 1985. We've obviously gone in very different directions since then. We're civil, we get along, but on policy, we're poles apart, as you would say.
All right, I got to ask you one more question, just so I know you're tight on time, but before I let you go, could a COVID stimulus find passage along with a budget vote to get into the weeds here?
I'm sorry, Kevin, I missed it.
Could it find it with a budget vote?
Yeah, we're doing it with the budget reconciliation process. We're going to Rules Committee on Friday morning. We're bringing the budget reconciliation, the bill, the American Rescue Plan, to the floor Friday night. And we'll pass it and then send it along to the Senate. The Senate will do with it what it will next week, and presumably we'll get it back the week of March 8th, and then we'll get it signed into law.
All right, we'll leave it there. I know you're busy, and I can hear it in the background right there on Capitol Hill. That's Budget Committee Chairman John Yarmuth joining us, the Democrat from Kentucky. Really, I guess, some busy times back there on Capitol Hill. Let's bring into this conversation our team, our Bloomberg politics contributor, Rick Davis, who was listening to that interview. Rick, I mean, you hear it right there, just the tension on the issue of minimum wage, as well as the response that Democrats are mounting to this ongoing criticism that Republicans don't want to bail out Democratic states.
Yeah, I think you picked the one key issue within this package that actually is the news item, and that is that the Republicans want to strip out this minimum wage component to the stimulus package, and the Democrats are holding firm. They see a lot of popularity around this package, and they see an opportunity to raise the rates. I wouldn't be surprised that if this gets stripped out in the Senate version, which I think everybody expects it to be done, that there isn't a standalone bill in the House to keep pressing this issue of minimum wage in the House of Representatives.
You know, and I was struck by Senator Chuck Schumer today, and I believe we've got the sound on this in our list. Senator Chuck Schumer said that Republicans want everyone on board to try to sink the latest stimulus bill. Here's the sound on that from Schumer.
According to a report in CNN, Republican leaders are maneuvering to get every single Republican member to oppose the emerging legislation. Make no mistake, Republicans oppose the American Rescue Plan to the detriment of the country.
Let's bring into this conversation Roger Zach Heim. He is the director of the Ronald Reagan Institute and the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and former General Counsel for the U.S. House Armed Services Committee. Roger, it's great to have you on the program. You hear that from Schumer, the political battle lines really being drawn out of the likely advancement of this $1.9 trillion stimulus bill as it heads to the Senate next week.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising. It's partisan. With $1.9 trillion, with a lot of Democratic priorities, you're going to have Republicans pushing back. If they wanted to fashion a bipartisan bill, it would look quite different, obviously focusing on those areas of the spending bill that go directly to COVID-19. As you get to some of these other areas, the connection to COVID becomes more attenuated, particularly where the money won't be spent in some cases out to 2024, 26, or 28. So the Democrats, they have majorities in both chambers, and they're taking advantage of it.
Hey, Roger, this is Rick Davis, and thank you for being on the program. And having served in the Reagan White House, I remember the president used to say, you know, I go into a legislative fight for 100% of what I want, but I'll sign a bill for 80% of what I can get. And should there have been a better effort by this administration to try and cobble together what has been in four previous stimulus bills, a bipartisan effort to solve this problem economically?
Well, yeah, you're channeling Reagan there, and great to be with you. And the answer is, I think, from a Republican standpoint, absolutely yes. And perhaps, I wonder if President Biden is thinking the same. He's got other priorities for his administration. And to come out with, you know, what the Wall Street Journal has called this blowout spending bill, it may limit his ability, that is, President Biden's ability, to get other things done, because they seem to be going for 100% of what they want.
You know, I think that point specifically in terms of regardless of the outcome, and it's likely going to pass on this economic stimulus package, the effect of what the Biden administration is spending on political capital, not just the top line budget number, but the political capital that is being expended by this White House, by Democratic leadership, is going to play a significant role in the cost of negotiations that they are able to do with the Democratic Socialists and the far left flank of their party on issues pertaining to immigration and, yes, including to infrastructure. But it's to bring it back to the immediacy of the current debate. You know, Fed Chairman Jay Powell once again reiterated today in his testimony that it could take more than 3 years to achieve their inflation goal. And this inflation debate has really been heating up amongst all of the policy wonks here in Washington, D.C. and up there on Wall Street. Here's the sound on this from Fed Chairman Jay Powell. Take a listen.
We want inflation to average 2% over time. And the reason we want that is that we want inflation expectations to be anchored right at 2% and not somewhat below 2%. We believe we can do it, believe we will do it. It may take more than 3 years, but you know, we'll update that every quarter. We update that assessment and we'll see how that goes.
Rick Davis, to punt it to you here, I mean, he's pushing back on concerns of prices rising and overheating, but has he been able to divorce himself from the political back and forth that is going on over this stimulus?
Yeah, I think to some degree he's coming out of a period of deflationary activity, right? And that hasn't helped the economy. The markets have responded well to what's been happening on the stimulus front for the last 2 years. But I think that Chairman Powell is just trying to put some rational bumpers around this inflation argument. And for him to come out today and say, look, we've got to target at 2%, and it may take us 3 years to get there, should calm the markets down a bit. That the Fed doesn't have a perspective on inflation that is going to, you know, let the markets get out of control. So I think what he's trying to do is be respectful of the inflation argument, but still make the case, as you pointed out earlier, Kevin, that that we need a stimulus. He's been very cagey about whether or not he wants this stimulus, but he does want more activity, and the unemployment number is what he seems to be mostly focused on.
And I can just keep going back to the fact that, to your point, the central bank is saying, yes, we need more stimulus, and even Republicans are talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. They differ, of course, in terms of that top line number. Much more coming up next. I'm Kevin Cirilli. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Beautiful day here in the nation's capital. I got to tell you, I've got spring fever. You know, I snuck a jog in. Don't tell the boss on my lunch break. Rick Davis is with us, Bloomberg politics contributor. Rick, I mean, spring is here. My dad got scheduled for a vaccine. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. We got to inject some optimism out there. Am I right, my friend?
I'm feeling it. I'm now feeling very guilty. I didn't get outside to run. I did run inside this morning, but it was too cold outside by the time I was up. But,
you know, I totally agree.
I honestly feel like this is a different period of time where, you know, maybe COVID is going to get tackled. We've got all these vaccines happening. Yes. Good work for your father to get a shot in his arm. That's great.
Get this. I got to give credit to my cousin who actually lives in Hong Kong. I have a cousin in Hong Kong. And she was staying up because, well, I guess she wasn't staying up, but the time difference worked in the favor. She kept hitting refresh and then got him in to a place back in Delco where I grew up. So anyway, shout out to my cousin for that. Good news. Good news. More people getting vaccines. Got to have that optimism. It was a better day for me, I guess, than for the leaders of the Republican Party in the House at their press conference. Did you see this, Rick Davis? So they gave a press conference, Leader McCarthy and Congresswoman Liz Cheney. And one of the reporters asked about whether or not former President Donald Trump should speak at CPAC this weekend. If this soundbite doesn't illustrate what's happening right now in the Republican Party, I don't know what does. Here's the sound on this exchange. It really captures it. Here it is. Take a listen.
On the leadership, especially Congresswoman Cheney, do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
Congresswoman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear my views about President Trump and the extent to which following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party.
I mean, Rick Davis, wow. Wow. You've got Kevin McCarthy saying, yes, he should speak. Liz Cheney saying, no, he should not.
Yeah, and this comes just a few weeks after a vote of confidence within the GOP caucus in the House that kept Liz Cheney in a seat of leadership. So I got to tell you, it is a party that has now got a fault line, and that fault line is Donald Trump. And it's even more distinct when you move over to how Mitch McConnell, the leader of the caucus in the Senate, feels about the same situation.
Yeah, Roger Zackheim's with us. He's the director of the Ronald Reagan Institute. Roger, is it the party of Reagan anymore, or is it a divide between McCarthy and Cheney?
This is the party of Reagan and Lincoln, and I know that because you speak to any Republican, and they'll tell you that. But in terms of the future of the party, that's the debate. And the clip you shared captures it, whether the Republican Party wants to have President Trump continue to define it, or whether other Republicans want to move on and find other voices to lead the party. And that won't be resolved in today's conference. It's going to play out in the coming weeks, months, and years, frankly.
So, Roger, and we're going to talk about your conversations on the national security front coming up in the next half hour. And you just had a brilliant interview with Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas for his positions on China. And we're going to get
Thank
to
you.
That. But another part of your role as the director of the Ronald Reagan Institute is you talk with incredibly influential Republicans. And so how does this party unify ahead of the midterms when the leaders are so bullish on recapturing control of the House of Representatives, when you've got such a clear divide right now between McCarthy and Cheney, and it's spilling over where they're standing next to each other on the same stage, socially distanced, of a press conference for the caucus?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. It's how do you win? How do you become the majority party? And they got very close in the House of Representatives in the last election. And that's what's going to define the direction they go. Elected officials want to be elected. They want to stay elected. They want to have the governing majority. They failed to do that in the last election. And depending on the recipe they put together for 2022, will determine whether it's a party that double downs on the ideas and principles that were advanced in the last administration, or if they go in a different direction.
And Roger, I was just going to say
this question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you point out the elections of the future, 2022, are going to define a lot of that. And obviously, we know Kevin McCarthy is working hard to try and get every help he can, and that would include Donald Trump, you know, for a Republican majority in the House. But when you look at the Senate, it's a totally different picture where you have, you know, 10 of the 14 Democratic seats that are up are in states that Donald Trump won in 2016. And only two of the states that are up for Republicans, 20 in total, Biden won in this last term. So it's a completely different animal of a different color, so to speak, when it comes to what Republican priorities are. And depending on whether it's a statewide race or a district race and who the primary might be.
That's a really great point. I'm curious to see if there's any oxygen in the room for a new type of Republican in the party of a new generation when you've got so many of these household name politicians drowning out so much of the noise. Much more coming up next. We go to one of those Republicans on the Hill. That's coming up next. I'm Kevin Cirilli. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live from our nation's capital, Bloomberg 99.1. To New York, Bloomberg 1130. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli.
Up next on the telephone line, Congressman James Comer, a Republican representing Kentucky's 1st Congressional District. He wrote to Chairwoman Carolyn Maloney today urging for transparency on Governor Andrew Cuomo, accompanied by none other than Rick Davis, Bloomberg Politics contributor. Joining us on the telephone line, Congressman James Comer, a Republican representing Kentucky's 1st Congressional District. He's also the top Republican on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Congressman, I want to talk to you about stimulus, but first I want to get to a letter that you sent regarding Governor Andrew Cuomo with regards to issuing a subpoena to the chairwoman of the committee, Carolyn Maloney of New York, about transparency as it relates to deaths in nursing homes. Have you gotten a response yet from the chairwoman?
We have not gotten a response yet. We sent the letter today. I would be surprised if she even responded, because the select subcommittee that has been investigating everything related to COVID is a subcommittee of the full committee of oversight. So this subcommittee has been on top of all the wrongdoing with respect to Cuomo's nursing home policy and transferring COVID positive patients to nursing homes from day one. In fact, I think this select subcommittee is the committee that first broke the news on that. So the people of America, especially the families in New York who have lost loved ones, deserve transparency. They deserve to know what actually happened. What was the decision-making process? Did Governor Cuomo, in fact, deflate the numbers on the actual nursing home death? And I think that that's something that the Oversight Committee should take up, since we've spent so much time and resources on the Select Committee. So Maloney should do this. It's her state. It's her committee. And we'll just be waiting to hear back her response.
We're going to keep a careful eye on that story, but let's also now turn to the financial matters of the day, particularly this $1.9 trillion stimulus plan that is likely going to pass out of the House of Representatives on Friday, and then it, of course, goes to the Senate. You detailed in a Fox News op-ed on the COVID spending that this is the wrong time and the wrong plan for the wrong time. Elaborate why you are against this plan.
Well, we have already passed $4 trillion in bipartisan stimulus. And we've learned recently that almost $1 trillion of that initial $4 trillion has been unspent. So if you can imagine, $4 trillion is more money than the federal government can even spend. Now the Democrats want to pass another $2 trillion. Only 9% of this $2 trillion stimulus plan that the Democrats are trying to push through, less than 9%, is COVID-related, that deals with putting COVID shots in people's arms and testing and things like that. The bill, it's a wish list. It's a liberal wish list for Pelosi. It's $350 billion for state and local government, so it's rewarding states that kept their state shut down. It's $135 million for the National Endowment for Arts, $12 billion for foreign aid, $50 million for Planned Parenthood. These aren't things that I think we need to be borrowing money from our children and grandchildren to pay for today, and that's what I've said about this bill. It's immoral because of what it does to the national debt that our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay for.
So Congressman Comer,
money goes for individuals, yes.
You point out that you can't find $1 trillion worth of the $4 trillion that's already been allocated to COVID relief. And I'm curious, because we've heard a lot of different numbers as to what's outstanding from the Trump administration COVID relief funds. And where is that money? I mean, that's the biggest number I've heard out in the public, and is it in accounts that are accessible to be applied to the current crisis?
It's scattered in different funds. You have a lot of unspent PPP funds. You have unspent state and local funds. The CARES Act was a broad piece of legislation that was very open-ended, and a lot of agencies, local municipalities, a lot of entities that got money from the CARES Act for healthcare-related expenses, for economic stimulus, they're just hoarding that money because they don't need it. And we listed in an oversight committee hearing all the different municipalities that were represented by Democrat members on the committee who represent cities that haven't spent 35 to 55% of their COVID funds, but yet they're asking for $350 billion more in state and local funds. It's unneeded. I fear that we keep printing money. Not only does it run the debt up on our children and grandchildren, it also is going to create inflation. So I think this is bad policy, and the American taxpayers deserve to know where the original $4 trillion spent. They don't even have that answer.
I'm going to rip up the script here because I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. People, when they think of Kentucky, they often think of, you know, bourbon, right? But you've actually put hemp and the CBD market on the map in Kentucky. You are one of the leading Republicans in the caucus, really, Congressman James mm-hmm. Comer, who's with us, who's really pushing for there to be more research and development in this emerging industry. What's the most prescient issue pertaining to the hemp industry as it relates to economic development in your district?
Well, in my district, there was a lot of hemp grown by Kentucky farmers for CBD oil. And the FDA will not make a decision on which direction they want to go with respect to CBD oil. You have a lot of CBD oil that's on the market today, and I take CBD oil. I've been very public about that. I think it's a very good alternative medicine type, but it needs to be regulated. You have a lot of companies that are good actors, and you have a lot of companies that are bad actors that are selling products that really don't have what they need. So we want to regulate it as a nutraceutical. Right.
Come back on and talk to us more about that, because I think that's an issue to watch. That's much more coming up next. We pivot to geopolitics. That's Congressman James Comer taking us down to Kentucky. I'm Kevin Cirilli. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg TV and Radio, accompanied by Rick Davis, Bloomberg Politics Contributor, and Roger Zackheim, who is the Director of the Ronald Reagan Institute. Let's pivot now to what I think is arguably the most important geopolitical story of the day. President Biden signing executive orders to study the U.S. dependence upon the global supply chain. He is calling for there to be a 100-day review period. And candidly, this is all about China and the relationship that the United States has on China, particularly as we have a shortage on a host of different products, including semiconductor chips. This is going to have massive implications for Japan, Taiwan, Australia, even to some extent. There are auto industry plants, folks, that are sitting idle across this country right now and threatening to put U.S. workers out of work. This is the one area, I'll be frank with you, where Republicans and Democrats do actually agree that the United States is too dependent upon China for its supply chains. And whether it's Senator Marsha Blackburn of the Republican Party or increasingly Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, or Democrats like Chairman of the Intel Committee, Mark Warner, they've been really talking about this for quite some time. I want to go to Roger first, because you actually spoke with Senator Cotton just a couple of days ago and about these issues. Do you think that this is just long overdue geopolitical policy, that the U.S. start to distance itself in order to better position itself in catastrophic situations from its reliance on China?
I mean, it's been building for some time now. One of the most significant achievements of the Trump administration was to focus squarely on the competition, is what policymakers call it, with China. And so what you saw today out of the Biden White House was continuity on this issue set. COVID-19 has only reinforced and made Americans truly internalize what dependency on China means and what it could mean to our security. Only difference is if you read the White House fact sheet about this executive order, it doesn't name China. As you recall, the Trump administration never missed an opportunity to name China.
Yeah,
you know,
even,
that's a great point.
They even named a virus after it, I believe.
I'm going to, you know, I think that's, it is fascinating that they have decided. What do you think that means? I mean, let me follow up, Roger. Why didn't they name China in their fact sheet in a policy that is specifically all about China?
Because it's not just about China. And it was focusing on America's need really not just be less dependent, but also to onshore within the United States. But it actually surprised me. President Biden spoke at an international conference virtually about a week ago or so, and had no issue calling out China. He talked about that it was the competition would continue. That's why there's continuity, and also identified areas of cooperation. But it is surprising to me that when you're talking about the criticality of these supply chains and onshoring, bringing this manufacturing back to the United States at a moment when we're still within this global pandemic. And as you referenced, we have manufacturers in the auto industry that can't get the chips they need. You might as well call it out. We all knew who the elephant in the room is.
Yeah, and I was going to say, if we could just dial back to what Kevin said earlier about the conversation you had with Senator Cotton. I mean, obviously not from the same ideological perspective as president, but the paper he wrote that you all were discussing, Beat China, Targeted Decoupling, this is exactly what Biden announced today, decoupling on computer chips, decoupling on EV batteries, pharmaceuticals, rare earth minerals. All of those are the things we've become dependent upon with China, and it certainly seems to me that without saying so, he's mimicking the arguments being made by a very conservative Senator Tom Cotton.
Yeah, Matt,
agree
with that.
Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
And Tom Cotton does not mince words, and the title of his report makes that pretty clear. Beat China. Tom Cotton was emphasizing this area of economic security and dependence on China. And there are a lot of Democrats in the Congress. Charlie Schumer, probably one of the biggest proponents of economic security. And for a long time has been talking about less dependence and actually saying that trade with China is something that needs to be addressed. And being a pure free trader actually undermines our security. So you're right. There is bipartisan consensus around a lot of this, although Tom Cotton certainly introduced the ideological component where he called out China using President Reagan rhetoric as an evil empire.
You know, and one of those Democrats is Congressman Tom Malinowski. He is a Democrat from New Jersey and actually served in the Obama administration State Department. He's actually been at the forefront. He's the first Democrat, I believe, in this Congress to say that the United States ought not to participate in the upcoming 2022 Winter Olympic Games. There have been a host of different Republicans who have already come out and said that the United States should not participate in the 2022 Winter Olympic Games, which, of course, Beijing is hosting because of China's human rights abuses and a host of other issues. Another one of those Republicans is Congressman John Katko, a Republican of New York. When you talk to whether it's Senator Cotton on the right or even Secretary of State Tony Blinken in the Biden administration, Roger, it's quite clear that there's this developing framework, and it's the one area that the previous administration would have with this current one in agreement of developing an alliance in the West with regards to cybersecurity, with regards to promoting techno-democracies, as the Blinken State Department has dubbed it, and getting our allies to participate in clean, so-called, as the Trump administration labeled it, 5G networks, and promoting continuity that would allow for that type of assurance amongst our allies that we're all reliant upon the same type of cyber protections. Do you think that this executive order today is a part of that broader strategy, Roger?
Without question. They're going to study this for 100 days, but it's pretty clear the direction they're going. this kind of overlap between America needs for national security and American manufacturing is something that the Biden administration wants to get its arms around and will develop policies that can make us less dependent. They will embrace allies and make allies part of the solution, which is important. And the difference here is between democratic countries, countries that embrace freedom, countries that are open. They will be on our side, and we need to make sure we have economically sound approaches to work with them to relieve not only our dependency on China, but to relieve their dependency on China. We're not talking about exporting soybeans. You know, that's not the problem, or even, you know, kind of low-end manufacturing goods. It's the stuff that really will determine who will be the economic powerhouse and, by extension, the national security powerhouse for the 21st century. That's what's at stake here.
Rick Davis, I mean, when you listen to Roger Zakheim, who of the Ronald Reagan Institute, discuss that, I mean, there really is, from a geopolitical sense, continuity of where Republicans and Democrats are in terms of the desired outcome, but there is massive difference in terms of the rhetorical approaches that both of the parties take. Who is set to gain internationally from this, as we have covered it, wanting to decouple in certain industries from China? Is it Japan, for example? Is it Australia, for example?
Well, I think Roger makes a good point about alliances and the West. When you start talking about trusted foundry, you know, what are the products we're going to care about? We are the biggest consumer in the world. And so when we turn to our Western allies and say, you know what, we would prefer, either if we can't make it at home, we'd buy it from you. So do we trust the manufacturing processes for chips in Australia? And do they have the capacity to service our needs? Let's buy there. Europe is exactly the same situation. Here's how we can circle the Western nations, liberal democracies alliance around industry, giving preference to those companies that don't have China exposure, and therefore isolate China on the economic terms that we can probably handle over the next 10 years.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Bloomberg Politics contributor Rick Davis and Roger Zakheim, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute. Be sure to go to their website to check out his conversation with Senator Tom Cotton. February is Black History Month, and Bloomberg Radio is celebrating pivotal moments in U.S. Black history each day. Here with today's installment is Bloomberg's Renita Young.
On this day in Black history in 1864, Rebecca Lee Crumpler becomes the first Black woman to receive an MD degree. To put that into perspective, in 1860, there were only 300 women out of 54,543 physicians in the United States. None of them were African American. Crumpler first worked as a nurse in Charlestown, Massachusetts, before she was accepted into the New England Female Medical College. It was during a time when male physicians claimed women did not have the physical strength to practice medicine. In 1883, Crumpler released Book of Medical Discourses, which was one of the first medical books written by an African American. That's Today in Black History. I'm Renita Young, Bloomberg Radio.
And that does it for me. My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg TV and for Bloomberg Radio. Coming up all throughout the week, we're going to continue to talk about that economic stimulus bill. This is Bloomberg.